Campaign Finance, buying elections for fun and profit. Second Sunday, the NBC News award-winning documentary series. This month, an examination of the price of politics. Campaign Finance, buying elections for fun and profit. Here now, NBC News correspondent Steve Porter.
Politics, Will Rogers once observed, has got so expensive it takes lots of money to even get beat with. That was back in 1931, when life was simpler and the costs of getting beaten lower. There are over 500,000 elective offices in these United States, and while the exact figure can only be guessed at, it's estimated that in the last presidential election year, 1972, a total of $400 million was spent to win or lose many of those offices, almost half a billion dollars. Politics is big business. Like any commodity, it is all too often bought and sold, sometimes for fun, more often for profit.
Someone has said that money is the mother's milk of politics.
Dr. Herbert Alexander, director of the Citizens Research Foundation, considered the nation's leading authority on election campaign finance.
Money is a fuel, a lubricant that keeps politics moving. American politics in particular requires a great deal of money because we have so many candidates at so many levels, and in addition, have campaigns for nomination. In America, in 1972, we spent about $400 million at all levels on politics. In excess of $100 million of that was spent just in electing a president.
It has long been the practice in U.S. politics for every candidate for public office, from town clerk to president, to depend upon voluntary contributions to get elected. It is the most flagrant single abuse in our democracy, according to Senator Edward Kennedy. It's a scandal, according to another politician, the nastiest thing in all of politics. Often vilified but never really seriously challenged, the practice of giving and getting money for election campaigns compromises and often embarrasses both giver and getter alike. It invites corruption, encourages favors, fosters aggrandizement. It is perhaps at the core of virtually everything that is wrong with America, and yet it persists. Frederick Wertheimer, legislative director of Common Cause, the National Citizens Lobby in Washington.
Well, it's not just a question of whether elections are bought and sold. It's a deeper problem. It's our whole process of government that is being bought and sold. And it's done in a sophisticated way, in a manner in which people use campaign contributions to obtain access, influence, political results. No one has to sit down and give someone money and in return say, I want your vote for a certain bill. It's not done that way. But the giver often knows that he wants certain results. The recipient understands that the person giving the money is giving it for specific reasons, and the end product is decisions are being made in direct relationship to campaign contributions coming in.
It wasn't always thus. It began with no money taking part at all. In the early years of our history, there were no primaries, conventions, caucuses, parades, polls, or for that matter, political campaigns. In the 1789 presidential election, the nation's first, George Washington was unopposed. In any case, he refused to promote his candidacy among electors and voters. And, too, the system was different in those days. When young George Washington ran for the Virginia House of Burgesses some 30 years earlier, for example, he provided the local citizens with what was then the customary way of winning votes: 28 gallons of rum, 38 gallons of wine, and 46 gallons of beer. So up until the second quarter of the 19th century, campaign costs remained minimal. Only property owners were eligible to vote, and they were relatively few in number. Electioneering was conducted mostly through the newspapers and at small public gatherings. All candidates played coy, it was noted, which in those days cost no money. The 1828 election, which brought Andrew Jackson to the White House, was the first in which the popular vote played a significant role. and it was the first in which large sums of money came into play. Getting out the vote then, in many instances, meant buying it. The price of an uncommitted vote in New York City in 1832 was $5. Individuals were encouraged to cast their ballots early and often. By 1872, money was as much a part of the political scene as campaign oratory and the American flag. That year, it's been estimated the Republicans spent a staggering $250,000 to elect Grant president. 100 years later, in 1972, the Republican candidate, Richard Nixon, spent over $56 million. Obviously, inflation has taken its toll. The campaign dollar doesn't go as far. But more than that, the electorate is more sophisticated now, and the methods of attracting votes are necessarily more sophisticated also. Sophisticated and costly. Not just at the presidential level, but at all levels. A seat in the House of Representatives, for example, could cost as much as $100,000 or more. David Adamany, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin and the state's Revenue Secretary. He's an authority on campaign financing.
It's hard to know, actually, but some estimates put it at between $70,000 and $90,000 in a congressional district. United States Senate contests vary widely according to the size of the state in which the race is held, but the usual estimates there are about 15 cents per vote in a state, with a minimum of about $100,000 to $125,000.
And for the presidency?
Well, this last election, of course, was a binge of spending. It now appears that President Nixon will have spent $56 million and Senator McGovern about $34 million. Those sums seem substantially too high. A general election campaign probably should be able to be waged vigorously by both sides for about 15 cents a vote, or roughly in the area of $20 to $22 million.
Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, the youngest member of the Senate and a relative newcomer to politics.
In my own circumstance, it took about $280,000, $85,000 thereabouts, almost $300,000 to run for the United States Senate. I was an anomaly. I was a 29-year-old kid taking on an institution in the state that had never, quote, elected a liberal Democrat. So we were able to get a lot of national attention. As a consequence of that, a lot of diverse groups and individuals outside of my state, in small contributions, contributed significant amounts of money so that we were able to raise the money without having to go the traditional route. But unless you're a woman running for the Senate, or a black, or a 29-year-old Irish Catholic in Delaware, or, you know, I mean, it's tough. You have to go where the big money is.
Where the big money is not always a pleasant place to go. Yet for most politicians, there is no choice. One exception to the rule was former Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, who rarely spent more than $10,000 on a campaign. Another exception, Senator George Aiken of neighboring Vermont, who's announced his retirement from the Senate after 34 years when his term is up next year. He spent even less.
I think when I came down here in 1940, that it cost about $3,000, mostly in the primary campaign. 1944, I had no expenses. 1950, no expenses. As I say, in 1956, it's just $5,000. In 1962, what was it, $16 or so. In 1968, I reported $17 expenses.
But how much did your last election cost, Ed?
Well, this was, I reported $17.09, but that was largely postage and thanking people for circulating papers, which I didn't ask them to do, and filing them with the Secretary of State. You see, it cost a dollar more in 68 than it did in 62 because the postage rate had gone up.
But as we said, George Aiken is a rarity. Generally, to attract votes, you need money. To attract money, you need exposure. To gain exposure, you need money. A vicious cycle. Albert Blumenthal, a New York State Assemblyman who ran for mayor of New York City last year and lost, he found the going expensive.
Media is the biggest expense.
for a mayoral campaign in New York City, it's impossible to have a media effort for less than $250,000. An ideal effort should cost more than $500,000. You can raise money from a broad spectrum of people who contribute 5 and 10 and 25, but never enough money to pay for a campaign, or at least that part of the campaign, which means that you begin to go to people who can make gifts of 1,000 and 2,000 and 5 and 10.
Richard Simpson, a professor of political science at the University of Illinois, who ran against the Daily Machine in Chicago 3 years ago and was elected an alderman.
In my case, my original election cost $25,000. We were able to raise $20 during the campaign and had a $5,000 deficit at the end, which is unusually good for local politics. We then got into a situation where I have to pay $45,000 a year to run the kind of office with the level of excellence that I think we need. We need to provide services to individual constituents. We need to provide legislative research. We need to help community organizations. And it takes two or three staff people, a headquarters, a phone bill, and the rest. The city of Chicago pays about $15,000 of that. I donate my entire salary, a legislative salary of $8,000, and that means each year we raise as much as if I were running for office. We raise at $20,000 a year. So it's not a one-time amount. It's a reoccurring amount every year. To be a decent public official, you have to have able staff, and you have to have to write to the constituents. You have to have contact with them, and that isn't done free.
Again, Herbert Alexander of the Citizens Research Foundation.
Politics is not expensive in this country if measured against almost any index, gross national product, disposable personal income, out of which contributions supposedly come. Politics is 0.1% of what governments are spending in this country on an annual basis. We estimated politics at all levels in 1972 to be $400 million. The two largest advertisers in this country are Procter & Gamble and General Motors. And for 1972, if you combine their advertising expenses, they were more than $400 million.
M.J. Rassant, director of the 20th Century Fund, which has made two separate studies of campaign costs. He was interviewed by Don Doak.
There's no doubt that we will see increased costs for elections if things go on as they are. One, simply because of inflation. Everything costs more, including the cost of campaigning. Secondly, the use of sophisticated campaign techniques, particularly in television, and the production costs there are high, and also other techniques that will be used on telephone and what have you, means that costs are going to increase.
How are these hundreds of thousands in congressional campaigns and the millions in presidential campaigns spent? For what does the money go, other than television? For
well, increasingly it is for television and for electronic use in general, but there are many other costs for advertising and print and in billboards, for mail, and mail is going up all the time, for canvassing, for all the costs attendant on trying to get someone elected. But the big bulk of it, even for congressional campaigns, certainly on the senatorial level, is in electronic media, and that is expensive.
Professor John Steinbruner of the Harvard Institute of Politics.
My feeling is that campaigns are not costing too much. Indeed, I think the contrary is better defended. I think we've gone back in the past and look at what campaigns cost 20, 30, 40 years ago. And when you consider the growth in the economy and the complexity of society since then, I think it's fair to say that campaign spending has rather lagged behind spending in other sectors of the government and the private economy. My feeling is that campaigns perform enormously important political functions. They educate voters, they educate candidates, They are a form of communication about the political preferences of people to those who represent them. It seems to me it would be hard to find anything that is more worthy of expenditure of funds.
Still, many critics, including some people who manage campaigns, feel that too much is spent, that half the money is being wasted. The problem is they can never figure out which half. Other critics feel it's not the amount of money that's the problem, but the source of the money. Robert Girard, professor of law at Stanford University.
The principal problem, it seems to me, is the fact that candidates are dependent upon large contributions from a limited number of persons for their campaign financing in many instances. And that gives these persons a great deal of influence and opportunity to influence these candidates. And it seems to me one thing we've got to do is reduce the dependence of candidates upon large contributions or a large amount of contributions from certain special interest groups.
It's these special interest groups that are the target of most of the criticism of our present campaign finance system. Former Senator Eugene McCarthy defines a special interest as a group, organization, or association with special axes to grind and special favors to ask. In the 1972 campaign, congressional candidates alone received over $10 million in contributions from various special interests, such as bankers, dairymen, insurance executives, oil men, and trade unionists. It came to a total of 26% of all contributions received by those running for Congress. And incumbents got most of it, $3 out of every four. Since 1907, it's been illegal for national banks and corporations to make direct political contributions. The same now goes for trade unions and any body or business working under a federal contract. The law has been largely ignored or skirted. It's also illegal for any one individual to give more than $5,000 to any one candidate for federal office. It's easier to get around that one than it is to slide on ice. It's a fairly well-known fact now that on the presidential level in 1972, the Associated Milk Producers arranged to contribute several hundred thousand dollars to the Nixon campaign. And ITT offered to underwrite much of the cost of the Republican convention, originally to be held in San Diego. Coincidentally, the milk producers were lobbying for an increase in federal milk supports, which they got. And ITT had several antitrust suits pending against it in the courts, most of which were settled. Also, there's the fact that two former cabinet officers, Attorney General Mitchell and Commerce Secretary Stans, have been accused of conspiracy and perjury, charged with conspiring to sell political influence for a $200,000 campaign contribution from financier Robert Vesco. With examples such as these and others too numerous to mention, many people are finding it increasingly difficult not to believe that elections are bought and sold every day. Senator Charles Mathias, Republican of Maryland.
It's a harsh way to put it, that they can be bought and sold, but the fact is it comes pretty close to that. When big money is brought to play in the election process, when much of it is disguised or the sources are kept secret, it comes pretty close to the auction block as far as elective office is concerned, and far too close to be tolerable.
It's no longer government of, for, and by the people, says Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota. It's government of, for, and by those who are willing and able to pay the price. There seems to be no shortage of them. Even so, many candidates with money or with access to money have failed to win public office. Indeed, Senator Mondale agrees with most of the experts that money alone cannot win an election.
The absence of money can defeat you, though, because you have to have enough money to buy enough radio and television and advertising and the rest to be heard, to travel. For example, I'm exploring the possibility of running for president. I have no money. Just the cost, say, of going to California and spending a week there, as I just did, can run quite a figure. And in order to get around so that people can see you and ask questions requires a lot of money.
Again, Professor David Adamany of the University of Wisconsin.
Unless a candidate has a certain amount of money, a fairly substantial amount, he can't even get into the contest because he can't afford to purchase the exposure in the mass media or to make the organization or to hire the professional staff that's necessary to get the campaign underway. So some level of money is necessary, but the biggest spender isn't necessarily always the winner.
Senator Mathias of Maryland, among those who wants to change the present system.
I'm a proponent of change for selfish reasons, among others. I've been a candidate for several public offices, for the state legislature, for the House of Representatives, and for the United States Senate. And I can tell you that the meanest, nastiest, dirtiest job that a public servant ever performs is going out and raising money for his own campaign. And you can sugarcoat that in a lot of ways. You can set up a meeting, call it a reception or a dinner, and it can be a very glamorous sort of affair with headliners and with decorations and a band and the flags and bunting, and money will never be mentioned and no cash changes hands, but you can smell the money. And it's a humiliating experience for a candidate to have to participate in this sort of an event, which is designed to ask for and to receive the money which will pay for the campaign. I think that those who have been asked for campaign contributions in America over the years have really been subject to a kind of extortion, because many of them would not normally have supported the candidate, except they feared that if they didn't, and if that candidate won, that somehow or other they or their business or their family might be subject to some sort of discrimination. That's a bad feeling to have abroad in this land. If anything is un-American, that is it.
Raising campaign funds, according to Hubert Humphrey, is the most distasteful, demeaning, and embarrassing aspect of elective politics. There are few who would not agree. Senator Biden of Delaware.
It's the most degrading thing in the world. I don't like going to people, especially people I don't respect, just because they have money. And many of the people who have money I don't respect, including the, you know, unions and big business. And to know that you're going to have to walk into them, even if you don't prostitute yourself, which I had the luxury of not having to do last time because we were able to broaden our base so much, to walk into some man or woman who you wouldn't invite home for dinner, or you wouldn't want to sit down and talk with your wife or your husband, to know that that person there holds a key to whether or not you can become a candidate, and you have to keep your mouth shut and say, "You crud, I don't feel like talking to you," that's degrading, I think. And I don't know of any man or woman who's run for public office who hasn't at least been put in that position. That's not to say that everybody who contributes large sums of money is that way. But, you know, those who control that lever know they control that lever. And some of them, you know, all but make you jump through the hoop.
Americans, for the most part, are too realistic of people to believe that political contributions are made without political favors being granted in return. It would be most unnatural, let alone ungrateful, for the recipient of a campaign gift not to want to express his thanks. In fact, there's hardly a member of Congress who hasn't, at one time or another, sponsored some obscure special interest bill for a contributor or wealthy constituent. But then most will draw the line as to what kind of bill they're willing to sponsor. There are few out-and-out crooks in Congress. Indeed, there are relatively few congressmen who are beholden to special interest groups at all, probably no more than 10%. Senator Dick Clark of Iowa.
They're beholden only in the most subtle kind of way. I think it's awfully hard to honestly say that if someone gives you $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 in a campaign that he's going to be treated, if he comes to your office or writes to you or telephones you, that he's going to be treated in exactly the same way as someone whom they've never heard of before. I just don't think that's going to be the case. Now, I have a slightly different attitude about the effect of that money. I tend to believe that what happens is not that senators or congressmen really sell out to the highest bidder, but rather that they tend to be supported. even though they may hold their views with strong conviction and vote their conviction, that they're supported in turn then come election time by those people who believe in their convictions. Now, sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. But either way, it results in all too often in those people getting reelected who have access to or the support of big money, whether you happen to agree with their view of government or not. So I don't think it's so much selling out to the highest bidder as it is having the highest bidders support those people who support their views.
One of the incredible aspects of American politics, says Walter Mondale of Minnesota, is that overall it's cleaner than we have any right to expect it to be.
But there is also more compromise and corruption than we should tolerate. And as I've often said, it's not that you can have a system that assures honesty, but you ought to have a system that makes it possible to be honest if you want to be. And increasingly, the cost of campaigns drive people running for office more and more to the big contributors. Many of these contributors give out of a sense of public interest, and I think that has to be said. They're not all bad people. But it makes for a situation where people with lots of money and who are so inclined can meet a politician who's also so inclined and cut a deal at the cost of the public interest, which could be compromising and corrupting. The American people increasingly think we have a Buy America system where the people of great wealth who are so inclined get a disproportionate influence at their expense, and I believe they're right.
Professor David Adamany.
Usually only 12% of the American people contribute to a candidate or party. And among that 12%, it's predominantly the very well-educated and the fairly wealthy. The poor are really excluded from this system. Then the special interests are major business groups of all kinds and, of course, union labor. And then a third area of substantial giving is among those whom we might call the ideologues, the people who feel deeply about causes. Some people say their giving isn't dangerous. I have a different view about that. I wonder where the moderates are represented when the ideologues are giving. Let me give you a few examples. The most startling grassroots campaigns in modern times have been those of George McGovern, Eugene McCarthy, Barry Goldwater, and George Wallace. What do those men have in common? What they have in common was that they were supported by a relatively small number of very ideologically committed supporters who raised for them very large sums of money. The moderate candidates get squeezed out. If you're good with the corporations or the unions, fine. If you're good with the ideologues, fine. If you happen to represent great masses of moderate Americans who don't fall in any of those categories, your opportunity to tell your story is probably quite small.
The small percentage of people who give money do so for a variety of reasons, some of them even laudable. But most give money to politics to gain results, to gain political decisions, to gain political appointments. M.J. Rossant of the 20th Century Fund.
A big donor to a presidential campaign has traditionally been offered one or another post, and often they have been in the form of ambassadorships, not always to important countries. They've gone to Iceland or Luxembourg. But in the past election, I think the ambassador to the Court of St. James was a major donor to the Nixon administration, and it is questionable whether he had any diplomatic sort of experience. And this, let me say, has happened under Democrats as well, and has been a traditional form, I think, of returning a favor for an individual donor.
President Nixon addressed himself to this question at a news conference on February 25th.
Ambassadorships have not been for sale, to my knowledge. Ambassadorships cannot be purchased, and I would not approve an ambassadorship unless the man or woman was qualified, clearly apart from any contributions.
Still, if a large campaign contribution doesn't exactly guarantee an embassy post, it certainly improves the chances of getting one. Rewarding large contributors with ambassadorships is an American tradition of long standing. Democrat and Republican presidents alike have followed the practice, but none more so than President Nixon. As far as we can figure, a total of 17 large contributors have been given overseas embassies since the president came to office. Among those who gave the most, Walter Annenberg, ambassador to Great Britain. He donated $250,000. Arthur K. Watson, ambassador to France. He donated $300,000. Ruth Farkas, ambassador to Luxembourg. She and her husband also gave $300,000, some of it even after the elections were over. Interestingly enough, the largest contributor to Richard Nixon over the years holds no government post whatsoever and claims he doesn't want to. His name is W. Clement Stone, a Chicago insurance man, a multimillionaire, and an arch conservative who may very well be the largest political sugar daddy of all times.
W. Clement Stone, in 1972, gave in excess of $2 million to the reelection campaign of Richard Nixon.
Dr. Herbert Alexander.
I have interviewed Stone several times, and he maintains that he got no preferments, he got no favors, that he gave because he was convinced that Nixon was good for the country.
We also interviewed Mr. Stone in his offices in Chicago. The reporter was Bob Sprentall.
Could you give us some idea of the range in which your contributions have come, how much you have contributed?
Well, of course, you know, the Nixon campaigns has been highly publicized, and the two campaigns of, what is it, around $4 million or so.
Why do you contribute to political campaigns?
Well, actually, I got involved in a big way in the Nixon campaign, but I feel that, from my viewpoint, it's important for every citizen to get involved either with time or some help of some kind, including funds if he doesn't have the time. In the Nixon campaign, of course, I was dedicated by virtue of the fact that I felt it was my one opportunity in my entire lifetime, perhaps, to change the course of history for the better.
How do you choose which campaigns you'll contribute to?
Well, actually, sticking to the Nixon campaign, I was particularly interested in the 70 campaign to see to it that as many senators and congressmen, regardless of political party, who would back the president in the important things, would have a chance to really make the grade.
Do you expect, as a contributor, anything in return for your contribution?
Yes, I do. Namely, the change in the course of history for the better. I feel that Mr. Nixon is going down as the greatest president that we've ever had by virtue of achievements. And that's the thing that really counts in the course of history.
So this is a personal thing that you expect to receive from the campaign contribution?
I and every other American citizen. That's right, sir.
Do you believe that it is moral for a person who can contribute as much as you have to do so?
Absolutely, for a reason. There are some individuals who contribute hours and weeks and months of time. Is that morally right or is it wrong? There are other individuals who are in a position, however, to help financially. At the time that I made my contributions to the campaigns for Mr. Nixon, my tangible wealth, or rather the family wealth, was over $400 million. So, to an individual who is limited in his wealth, let's say a tangible wealth of $5,000, $100 or $150 might be a sizable sum. It is absolutely right, particularly in view of the fact that it is imperative to neutralize the powers of other organizations. Under our system, there should be the right to neutralize negative powers if you feel those powers are negative.
Do you intend to continue making campaign contributions?
It all depends. I doubt very much if I will go to the extent that I have in the Nixon campaign for many reasons. One is I don't think they're going to let me. Next of all, I don't think it'll be necessary. I've achieved my purpose, I believe.
Multimillionaire insurance man W. Clement Stone, who by his own accounting has given some $4 million over the years to various Nixon campaigns. What has he gotten for his money? Well, at one time he expressed the desire to be an ambassador or cabinet secretary. Now he seems content with an occasional invitation to a White House dinner and with being able to speak to the president on the telephone any time he wants. About once a month, he says. But it would be naive to think that all most big money givers want is a free meal and the ability to say, guess who I spoke to on the phone the other day? Regardless of whether or not a contributor has anything specific in mind, money buys access. Having access to men in power, whether it be at the White House, the Capitol, or City Hall, means that doors are opened, red tape is cut, the ways are greased, and one goes toward the head of the line. It is a fact that in every recent administration, be it Democrat or Republican, there have been men on the White House staff whose job it has been to satisfy the particular problems of large contributors. Not all of these large contributors, incidentally, are wealthy individuals. True, most Republican candidates get much of their money from big business, but most of the Democrats get much of their money from big labor. Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware.
In my case, for example, out of the close to $300,000, somewhere in the area of $40,000 came from labor. Now, the fortunate thing about labor is it's very fragmented. There's not a unanimity in purpose or design other than on certain basic things like right to work. No group contributed more than 2.5-3% of my overall figure to my campaign, which again is critical. If a guy only spends $50,000 and 90% of it comes from one source, that's a good deal more influence on that guy than the same person who gets $40,000 out of a $1 million campaign. But traditionally, labor has been a big backer in a small way, relatively speaking.
Like corporations, labor unions have learned how to be active in campaigns by getting around the laws prohibiting direct contributions. It's been argued that the laws are unenforceable, unduly restrictive, even silly. After all, in a free capitalistic society, money is supposed to make things work. There's nothing wrong with the system. Except one thing. The guy with the most money has the loudest voice. And that's not what democracy is all about. Fred Wertheimer of Common Cause.
The present system has to be changed, and there are two aspects to it. We've got to eliminate the corrupting role that money has played in politics by cutting down to only small contributions and eliminating these large campaign contributions that have been used to buy political results. But secondly, we have got to get ourselves a competitive system of politics. We've got a monopoly system in this country. Incumbents get all the campaign financing. They've been elected overwhelmingly in the last three Congresses, more than 95%. And one of the main reasons is that challengers don't get any money under this system because they don't have any power. If you're going to have a system of competition in politics and therefore make our elected officials more responsive to people all around the country, you have to get rid of this present campaign finance system, which is really a system for incumbents only.
Obviously, if you're in the market for some influence peddling, it pays to go where the influence is, namely the man in office, the incumbent, Senator Dick Clark of Iowa.
In the last election, it's been analyzed by Common Cause that those people in office, in federal office, that is senators and congressmen, were able to raise about twice as much, slightly more than that actually, but about twice as much as those people who are not in office and running. So it's an enormous advantage under the present system of private financing for an incumbent, to say nothing of the other great advantages, free mailing privileges and so forth.
It's almost impossible to place a monetary value on those free mailing privileges and so forth that Senator Clark talks about, but some experts think it's between $40,000 and $50,000. Maybe this has something to do with the fact that in the last three congressional elections, more than 90% of House incumbents who stood for re-election were returned to office. Says one critic, there is neither a Democratic Party nor a Republican Party in Congress. There is an incumbency party. David Adamany of the University of Wisconsin.
At the present time, the incumbent has two levels of advantage. First of all, he has the advantage of being in office. He has a staff. He has publicity. He can provide certain services to constituents. His second advantage is that he ordinarily raises more money than his challenger. In fact, the margins run as high as 2-1 for incumbents over challengers. So if we provided equal money for both sides through public financing, we'd eliminate one of the two advantages of incumbents. I doubt that it's ever possible to eliminate the other advantage, the advantage of holding office.
It's obvious to most people that changes are needed. The big question is, what kind of changes? Again, David Adamany.
The changes, I think, should, in a rough way, include some spending limits and to try to put a curb on excessive spending. We ought to have a tight limit on the amounts that can be given to politics. We ought to have some public money in this. It's a public function informing the voters. And if we're going to get the special interest money and the big money out of politics, we're going to have to get some other money in. That other money is going to be tax money. Many European countries have gone to this system already. And then we ought to have full disclosure. We ought to know every dollar given and every dollar spent. And then we ought to have a tough enforcement mechanism. We ought to treat campaign finance law violations the way we're treating Watergate. We ought to have an independent prosecutor who can go after men high or low, no matter how powerful they are.
One of the many reforms suggested, without doubt the most important one and most controversial one, is public financing.
Public financing is important because it gives the opposition, the challenger, money to wage a campaign which hauls the incumbent into the public spotlight, compels him to defend his record, exposes his conduct of office, and holds him up to the public scrutiny. Without opposition, the incumbent gets a free ride.
The basic premise here is simple. Why shouldn't public money finance public elections? Proponents say that this way the candidate would be beholden only to the electorate. The challenger would have access to as much money as the incumbent, and both would have equal access to the public. Again, Senator Biden.
There has to be equal access to the media. Now, there's two ways of going. One is to encourage and or prompt or force the radio stations and television stations to provide free time. I don't like that idea. But that leaves me with only one option, if you accept my basic premise that there need to be equal access. I think what we have to do is provide for the funds for television and radio and access to those media through a form of federal financing of elections, partial federal financing, limiting the amount of money you can spend, the amount of time available to anybody, but making it equal access.
While equal access to the media certainly is one aspect of the problem, the central point remains equal access to money. Those who oppose public financing, and there are many, do so on many grounds. The main one is cost. There is no justification, say the critics, of increasing the taxpayers' burden by giving the politicians public money to run their campaigns. An interesting argument. But as Al Smith used to say, let's look at the record. The estimates are that the 1972 federal elections cost between $200 million and $250 million. If those elections were financed with public funds, it would have cost each citizen a little over a dollar apiece. Even if the number of potential candidates in the primaries increased threefold because of the availability of federal funds, it's estimated that the cost per taxpayer would still be under $2 a year. That's with total public financing. Some advocates of reform feel it isn't necessary to go all the way. They feel small contributions should be permitted. Senator Walter Mondale of Minnesota.
We passed a bill in the Senate in December, which lost in the shuffle the last few days, which we worked out with Common Cause and with many of my colleagues here, which called for a system of cleaning up private financing so that you could only give so much, you had to disclose your sources, it had to be in check form and not in cash, and added to that a system of public financing.
Senator Clark of Iowa.
I think many people feel that we ought to leave the right for people to include small contributions up to $100, something of that kind. But as soon as you try to write that legislation, you find that there are many, many ways of getting around it. As long as you have private financing, there are going to be loopholes and ways of getting around that.
Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware favors a middle ground, but with rigid controls.
I think we have to limit the amount that can be contributed by an individual or a group, number one. I think, number two, we have to limit the overall amount that can be spent. Number three, I think we have to provide for absolute total disclosure of every penny that is, in fact, contributed, small or large, and hopefully they'll all be small if my legislation, that which I support, which calls for limits of up to $1,000 for an organization and $100 for individuals, you know, if that goes through. And thirdly, I think there has to be a mechanism by which the federal government would provide for, out of general tax revenues, who under the scrutiny of a special agency would be set up, like the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, to monitor the distribution and use of the funds in the sense, use not in whether or not you can buy balloons or make a speech with it, but whether or not you can put it in your pocket or pay somebody off or use it for a legitimate campaign activity.
There are several reform proposals being considered in the Congress at the present time, and one being offered by the White House. That bill, among other things, would make foreign contributions to federal campaigns illegal. President Nixon, at a news conference on March 6th, spelled out the other major provisions of the bill.
One is that all cash contributions are prohibited if they are above $50. All contributions in cases of presidential campaigns will be limited to $15,000 per person per candidate. In the case of congressional and senatorial campaigns, $3,000. One thing that we do not do, however, is to endorse public financing. I know there's a great deal of support for public financing in the Congress, and it may be that eventually, if a bill does reach my desk, it will be in it. I oppose it for this reason. The public financing proposals before the Congress, for the most part, are ones that would have the campaigns financed out of the general treasury. Now, what this would mean, very simply, would be that a taxpayer would be taxed to support a candidate or a party to whom he was opposed. That is not right. I think that that would, in effect, be taxation without representation. And so, therefore, for that and other reasons, I oppose public financing.
President Nixon is not the only one against public financing. Ohio Congressman Wayne Hayes, among others, is also against it, and he makes no bones about it. Wayne Hayes is the chairman of the House Administration Committee, which must approve any campaign reform legislation before it can be considered by Congress. What he supports is a system, now in its second year, by which each taxpayer can check off a box on his income tax form and thereby donate a dollar to either the Republican or Democratic presidential candidate.
Well, there's a great many people say that the public wants public financing out of the Treasury. I don't find that to be true, but we're proposing to put in this bill that the total presidential campaign will be financed out of the checkoff on the income tax, which costs the taxpayer nothing. He can check off that he wants a dollar of his taxes to go for this. And if that amount raises the $40 million, which we're limiting the two parties to, that's $20 million each, then the presidential campaign will be totally publicly financed.
It's important to note here that the system Chairman Hayes supports and is talking about would affect the presidential campaign only. Races for the House and Senate would still be run under the old system of private financing with some restrictions. Again, Chairman Wayne Hayes.
There's a limit on expenditures of $60,000 in a congressional race per candidate. That's in the primary and then an equal amount in the election if that's necessary. And in a senatorial race, I think we'll probably wind up with $75,000 or 5 cents times the population of the state, whichever is larger. And we have, tentatively at least, subject to ratification by the committee, although there's general agreement, that no individual can contribute more than $25,000 to all campaigns that he may desire to contribute to, that is a total. We think that this will really put a lid on excessive expenditures.
As has been said before in this program, many of the experts feel that excessive expenditures is not the problem, but that the source of campaign money is. Indeed, it's felt by some that a limitation of spending would only favor the incumbent more. And critics charge that that's the reason why Wayne Hayes supports one measure and opposes the other, to favor the incumbent. Hayes is one of the most powerful and feared men in the House of Representatives. Where he leads, others are sure to follow. It's doubtful whether any reform legislation can get out of his committee to the floor of the House without his approval. Therefore, it's felt by many observers that the chances of significant campaign reform, including the public financing of congressional elections, are very slim unless there's an outpouring of public sentiment. Fred Wertheimer of Common Cause.
One of the biggest barriers to public financing in the country today is that elected officials of Congress have to vote against their own personal self-interest to support public financing, because presently they get all the advantages under the present financing system. Under a new system, it is going to be more equally divided. There's going to be greater competition. Members of Congress are going to have to vote for the nation's best interest over their own self-interest if we're going to get public financing.
New York Assemblyman Albert Blumenthal.
The public doesn't understand it. It's being sold a bill of goods. People are being told, well, we don't want our tax dollars to go to pay politicians' campaign expenses. That's fallacious. Our tax dollars are going to pay candidates' expenses. What we wanted is on top of the table, not under the table.
Under the table, the public is no doubt spending a good deal more than the few dollars a year per person it would take to subsidize elections at all levels of government. For example, in 1972 alone, American consumers paid at least $500 million more for milk. That was after the dairy producers made huge contributions to the president's re-election committee and the administration raised milk support prices. And that's only one example. Senator Biden of Delaware, among others, says the time is ripe for reform.
If we don't get it now, I don't know under what atmosphere we ever will get it. Because I think finally the American people have realized that not only do the politicians rip off the system, but the people rip off the politicians. Because if you force an honorable man or woman to run for office by only the only means by which they can run, and everyone acknowledges it, if they have a great deal of money, you limit the field to people who are wealthy or who are different for some reason, or you force them into the position where they may at best have to compromise their principles.
Part of the problem is that too many people don't care. They feel that politics is a dirty business, not worth soiling their hands with, certainly not worth donating a dollar to. Maybe that's why it often is a dirty business. The overwhelming majority of Americans don't give a single penny to any politician. They are, as someone termed them, the real silent majority, that overwhelming preponderance of citizens who believe the country is going to pot, but are doing nothing to stop it. The old line, your public servants serve you right, has never been truer. This is Steve Porter, NBC News.
Second Sunday, campaign finance, buying elections for fun and profit. This program was written and produced by Edward Hanna, directed by Edward Smith. Technical supervision, Warren Hogan. Research assistants, Margot Houghton. This program was produced under the supervision and control of NBC News. Your announcer is Jerry Damon.